Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, March 26th, and I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, housing subsidies lose funding as homelessness program sunsets. Road closures and water interruptions expected as Arcata upgrades old water mains. Humboldt mycologist warns foragers after suspected mushroom poisoning. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Recent federal political changes are impacting Humboldt County's main housing subsidy program. Daniel Mintz reports.
With the advent of the Trump administration, Humboldt County's Section 8 housing support program has stopped, and an emergency housing program's imminent sunset could increase homelessness. Discussed at the March 24th Board of Supervisors meeting, what was described as a shocking political turnabout has upended the county's ability to give people housing assistance. Cheryl Churchill, the executive director of the Joint Humboldt County and Eureka Housing Authority agencies, said the county's main voucher program, Housing Choice, better known as Section 8, is now suspended indefinitely.
Unfortunately, our waitlist is currently closed, and HUD has mandated that we cannot issue any new vouchers until they greenlight us. So basically, as of the election in 2024, they said pause all issuance of vouchers. They recaptured all the funding that we had in reserves. We were having a high growth year, and that all stopped at the end of 2024. It also stopped for 2025 and again this year. So what the voucher program seeing currently is a slow attrition until we are able to issue vouchers again.
The county's emergency housing voucher program, which Churchill said, quote, came during the pandemic as a response to the critical problem we were having with the COVID-19 spread, and especially in our homeless population, is about to end as well. The program was expected to be funded through 2030, but rent hikes during the pandemic gouged into it, and the county's funding will run out in early 2027, leaving voucher holders without housing support. Churchill described the program's enrollment and the impacts of its loss.
We were thrilled to be able to provide the 182 vouchers that were allocated to our community and assist that many people in getting housed. We currently are serving about 102 households still with these vouchers. It's just a normal process of attrition. This population, sometimes we have more difficulty getting paperwork turned in. We have more issues with eviction. So you do see a higher attrition rate. But I wanted to bring this to your attention because our county needs to be aware that this funding will be going away. And HUD currently has no plan or no program to convert them. HUD has suggested converting them to Housing Choice voucher assistance, but when they've prevented us from being able to issue those vouchers, it means they're essentially blocking our ability to convert these households. Without future support, it most likely means a return to homelessness for these people who have, you know, been able to gain stability over the last handful of years.
Voucher programs related to tax credit-funded housing projects are continuing, including the Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing Program and the Mainstream Program for families with adult members who have disabilities. Churchill said the county will refer some people to those programs in the absence of Section 8. The tax credit housing is mostly located in Eureka and Arcata. Board Chair Mike Wilson described housing as a need that's being snubbed by the Trump administration.
We had an election. It elected a federal administration at all levels that is hostile to housing first approach. It's hostile to housing people in general. And in H.R. 1, the big crappy bill, as I would call it, defunded what is functionally the best way to keep people from being unhoused and being homeless, which is to subsidize housing. And this is subsidizing housing that exists today. This is, it's not building new, I mean, it is building, we're obviously left, you're seeing projects where we're leveraging new housing with these subsidies, but it also subsidizes existing housing in its current format. So the investment's already been made, the capital's already input into the system, and now we're looking at have an administration that seeks to defund that in a bill that sought to give tax advantages to the wealthiest people in this country in order to pay for that. It's just mind-blowing to me, the problems that we're going to be seeing from that are coming due to those choices, not to mention the amount we're spending on a ridiculous war.
There was some positive news in Churchill's presentation. The Eureka Housing Authority owns and manages 270 housing units, and more are being developed. Churchill described projects that will result in new and rehabilitated units in Eureka and development of the new Everding Community Center there. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The city of Arcata is in the middle of a major water infrastructure upgrade. The work is part of the Steel Waterline Replacement Project, a months-long construction effort to replace some of the oldest and most vulnerable water lines throughout the city. KMUD spoke with Stephen Liu with the City of Arcata Engineering Department. He is the senior project manager and is overseeing this project.
The Steel Waterline Replacement Project is targeting replacement across the City of Arcata and of water main infrastructure. And it's titled Steel Waterline Replacement Project because we've been prioritizing the replacement of infrastructure that predates the majority of the water system in Arcata, which was installed in the 60s and 70s. And so these are steel water lines that were actually mostly replaced in that time period. And so these are the major sort of weak points in our water system.
The work will also include replacing more than just the old main pipes.
We are replacing water mains, and then where we're replacing the water mains, we're replacing water services and meters. Residents and businesses on those streets, we are also replacing control valves at the intersections.
The project is expected to continue through mid-November, though Liu says the timeline can shift.
The project is currently estimated to run through the middle of November, and that's subject to change based on, you know, sometimes we find areas that need some more work, or they encounter some other conditions in the ground, or other issues that could delay construction.
Liu says each block of work follows the same sequence. Crews start by installing a temporary water line along the gutter, disinfecting it and running bacteria tests, before switching residents over. After that, they close the intersection for a day to install new control valves, which can mean a short water interruption for nearby homes and businesses.
A typical replacement kind of time window would be an initial 2 to 3 day process where they occupy the parking spaces along the shoulder of the road and they are setting up a temporary water line or where the businesses and residents on that street will be supplied water during the course of construction. And this temporary water line is installed along the gutter or on the curb. And it goes through the same process as installing a brand new water main underground, so a full disinfection, and then two series of bacteria tests to make sure it's completely disinfected and safe for use. So it goes through that process, the residents are hooked up. So that's about a three-day kind of process, and the residents and businesses on that street can expect like a short window of impact to switch over from their current water service to this temporary water service. Once that is complete, the contractor will do an intersection closure, and they will install the control valves at that intersection. They're water valves. I'm just calling it control valves because that's what they're used for, is to control the flow of water. And typically when they do that, there will be up to a four-hour interruption during the day for businesses and residents about a block away from that intersection.
From there, the crews dig and install the new water main, reconnect each service, and run final disinfection tests, a process that takes about 2 weeks per block. Liu explained where the construction is going to happen, giving streets and dates for future construction on this project.
The first major intersection of work that's going to be a rather significant thoroughfare is Alliance Road / K Street at 13th. And so that's the intersection where the work will occur. And so Alliance Road is a pretty major thoroughfare, and there will be a detour. There will be a closure to through traffic, basically at Alliance Road and M Street and 15th Street. And so those traffic will be diverted around, but local traffic and business traffic can still come through Alliance Road. It's just that by the time you get to 13th Street, there will be a closure for the work there. That will start around April 1st. And similarly for businesses that are south of 13th Street at Alliance/K there, local traffic can come up through from the 12th Street side of K Street and still access there, but there will be a like a no-through traffic from 13th Street south to 12th Street. So that's coming up, again, April 1st. And then, you know, work is occurring right now on 8th Street between 13th and 12th. And then the next kind of block of work will be I Street between 10th and 11th. And that's coming up early next week.
He says similar short-term closures will continue to rotate through the project area as crews move block by block. He said the most important thing for drivers is to slow down and follow traffic control signs as crews work in active construction zones. He says people can still reach their homes and local businesses during most closures, and workers on site can help if anyone is unsure about whether it's safe to pass.
Please obey and just be observant of different traffic control. You know, we are trying to ensure a safe working environment and that the public can stay safe too. And so just if you are going through these closures to access local businesses, to access your home, just please drive slowly and safely because it is an active construction site. Everyone's just trying to get the job done.
He says signage will make it clear which roads are fully closed and which allow local access. And he's asking drivers to be respectful of the crews doing the work. Lou says the best place to stay updated is the City of Arcata's active construction website, where residents can find a summary of the project phases, expected water interruptions, and a live map of current and upcoming road closures. He updates it regularly, and he says it's the most reliable tool for planning commutes, school drop-offs, and navigating construction throughout the project. A recent mushroom poisoning in Humboldt County has stirred concern among foragers and raised questions about what species may have been involved. Retired physician Dr. Bruce Kessler, a founding member of the Humboldt Bay Mycological Society, wants listeners to understand both the limits of what's known and the basics of mushroom safety. Kessler has been following the case through emails with the county health officers, but he stresses he does not have inside information.
I have to say I have no firsthand knowledge of this current poisoning. I have been on an email chain with Candy Stockton, our county health officer, and I've seen a whole bunch of emails fly back and forth. But to the best of my knowledge, there has been no definitive identification of the mushroom that has made this fellow sick. There's been speculation that it might have been a mushroom called Amanita ocreata, commonly known as the Western Destroying Angel. But as I said, I don't have any specific information as to what the mushroom was that he ate that has made him sick. I've also seen the reports in the media that there was a misidentification between a puffball and this mushroom. I can't say anything about the truth of that statement either.
He explained that there are a giant variety of mushrooms in this area, some poisonous and some edible. He highlighted Amanita phalloides, the mushroom that most poisonings in California this year have been attributed to.
There are many different mushrooms that grow locally that if you eat them will make you sick. There are also many mushrooms in this area that are really good to eat. And so I tell people, if you're going to go out and eat mushrooms, you really should be able to learn the basics of mushroom identification so you don't get yourself in trouble. When you hear about cases of mushroom poisoning in California, and there's been an unfortunate rash of mushroom poisonings in the Bay Area this past winter. I believe 4 people have died and a number of people have survived but with liver transplants. And those poisonings have all been attributed to a mushroom called Amanita phalloides, or the death angel is the common name for it. Until 3 years ago, Amanita phalloides had never been found in Humboldt County, the best of our knowledge of anybody in our club, which is not all that surprising because Amanita phalloides is not native to North America. It's actually a European mushroom that accidentally was brought to California on the roots of trees. The fungus that is the provides the energy for the mushroom actually grows in conjunction with the roots of trees in a, what we call a mycorrhizal relationship, where the fungus takes energy from the plant, but it breaks down minerals in the soil and helps the soil, the tree, to grow as well. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship. But apparently Amanita phalloides was introduced into the Bay Area by mistake in the 1930s and has been gradually spreading north ever since. And in the year 2024, it was first found in a hillside by Shelter Cove. It's also now been also found at least in one location in the city of Eureka as well. So Amanita phalloides is spreading northward.
He then gave the key features to look out for that defines a mushroom in the Amanita family.
If you're going to collect mushrooms, you really should be able to identify Amanitas in general. Amanita is the name of a family of mushrooms or a genus. And as a group, they're actually relatively easy to identify. The key features that make an Amanita, all Amanitas are gilled mushrooms. That is, if you turn the top, the cap over, they have gills, not pores. The gills are always white. And if you do a spore print, the spores are a pure white in color. The gills go right to the edge of the stipe or the stem. They don't run down the stem. They just go to the edge. And most Amanitas have the remnants of a partial veil, or what is sometimes called a ring or an apron, on the stipe. And if you dig the mushroom out of the ground, get your fingernails dirty. Don't cut it off of the surface. Actually, dig it out so you can see what the base of the mushroom looks like. All Amanitas have a bulbous base. So if a mushroom has white gills and white spores, and the gills don't go down the stipe, and it has a ring or an annulus around the stipe, and it has a bulbous base, it's almost certainly an Amanita. Now, there are Amanitas that are actually good to eat, but they are not a beginner's mushroom. I would never recommend that anybody eat an Amanita until you consider yourself to be an expert in mushroom identification. So if you just follow those rules, it's hard to kill yourself by eating mushrooms.
For people interested in foraging, Kessler gave simple advice.
So if you're going to go foraging mushrooms to eat, be able to identify the most deadly mushrooms and then identify the ones that you really are looking for. Maybe you want to collect chanterelles. There are false chanterelles, but they're pretty easy to identify true chanterelles from false chanterelles. Boletus edulis is a gourmet mushroom, and it's in the family of boletes. They have pores. They don't have gills. That's relatively easy to identify, and there are very few boletes who will make you sick as well.
Another possibility of the mushroom that the local ate was misidentifying a puffball mushroom.
There certainly are puffballs in our area. Most of the puffballs that grow around here in the fall are pretty small. It'd be unusual to see one that's as big as a ping pong ball. But there is a puffball that grows in the springtime and that can be bigger than a softball. Not as big as a soccer ball, but very large. But if you have a puffball and you cut it in half and it's fresh, the inside should be pure white, sort of like a white sponge, if you will. If it's starting to form spores, it'll start to get brown in the middle, and it still won't be poisonous, but it will taste bitter. So you probably don't want to eat a puffball if it's going to taste bitter. So the question is it possible this person thought an Amanita was a puffball? And I'll say there's only one possibility I could think of. When Amanita mushrooms are first popping out of the ground, they haven't yet opened, and they're what we call a button stage. And an Amanita button could sort of look like a puffball coming up. But if you take that mushroom and you cut it in half, a puffball will be pure white throughout, or maybe turning a little brown in the middle. You won't want to eat that one anyway. But if you cut the puffball in half and you say, oh my goodness, I can actually see a little mushroom getting ready to pop open inside this, what I thought was a puffball. Well, it may not be a puffball at all. It might be the button stage of an Amanita. And so I guess it's conceivable somebody might have mistook the button stage of an Amanita for a puffball. Now, the other mushroom that's been questioned that might have caused this poisoning is called Amanita ocreata, also called the destroying angel. And it has all the same features as Amanita phalloides. It has white gills that go up to the edge of the stipe, but not down the stipe. It has white spores. It has an annulus or ring around the stipe, and it has a bulbous base. The top looks different, and if you get any good mushroom book, you can look at the different features.
Kessler then went into detail about what makes Amanita phalloides so dangerous.
You know, 99% of the time when you read in the paper about somebody dying of mushroom poisoning on the West Coast, it's from an Amanita phalloides. And the reason is that it contains a poison called amatoxin. And when amatoxin gets into your body, it binds to enzymes in the liver, and it basically stops the liver from working. And people die of liver failure. And it doesn't make you sick right away. As a matter of fact, most people that have eaten Amanita phalloides and survived say, you know, it tasted good. So you can't rely on taste to tell you whether or not a mushroom is safe to eat or not. Typically, people who eat Amanita phalloides feel fine for several hours. Then they may have an upset stomach. And they figure, oh, you know, maybe it was that mushroom I ate, but they don't think much of it. Then by the next day, they feel better. But by the second or third day, they're starting to come down with symptoms of liver poisoning. Typically, their eyes start turning yellow, they become jaundiced, and basically, when the liver stops working, the only known cure for it is a liver transplant. Now, if somebody's only eaten a small amount, they may survive long enough for the liver to heal itself, but we have no medications that will help someone who's eaten Amanita phalloides. The best we can do is provide what we call supportive care. You know, one of the jobs of the liver is to make clotting factors to make our blood clot. And when the liver stops working, people start bleeding. Well, we can give people blood transfusions and transfusions of clotting factors. You know, and other things to tide them over. But, you know, they're, as I said, you have to basically hope, you know, typically what happens if it looks like somebody isn't going to make it, their name gets to the top of the list of people waiting for liver transplants who may not be as sick. And you better hope that somebody who is agreed to be a donor is found to be brain dead somewhere in California, and you have the same blood type as that person, because that's the only chance you'll have.
Dr. Kessler recommends Mushrooms of the North Coast by Siegel and Christensen as the best local field guide, and says it's easy to find in bookstores around Humboldt. He says the safest way to learn is to go with someone experienced who can point out key features, adding the old saying.
You know, we have a saying that there are old mushroom hunters and bold mushroom hunters, but no old bold mushroom hunters.
Kessler ends by urging people to learn their local mushrooms. Enjoy the North Coast's rainy season abundance. Turning to Mendocino, throughout the month of April, CAL FIRE will be conducting a prescribed burn on Shamrock Ranch near Laytonville. Nat Cardos reports.
Starting April 1st, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, CAL FIRE, Mendocino Unit, will be conducting a vegetation management prescribed burn at the Western Hills of Ukiah. This prescribed burn will treat about 300 acres of habitat, which consists of chaparral and understory vegetation in the oak and mixed conifer woodlands. KMUN News spoke with Sherry Weiss, a fire prevention specialist at CAL FIRE, for more information on the burn.
So we will be out there to reduce fuels out in that section of the county. We have been working on a Shamrock Ranch for several years, and when we burn out there, we have specific plots that we burn on each different time we go out. So it creates a bit of a mosaic in the fuels out there.
Shamrock Ranch is located in the northern portion of Mendocino County, east of the 101 Highway, and southeast of Laytonville. Residents may see smoke during this time, as the burn will be occurring intermittently throughout the month, going no later than April 30th.
And like I said, we have that entire project is mapped out in plots. So we might be working in one specific plot one year, and then we'll move to another plot another year. So like I said, it creates a mosaic of, it just breaks up the continuity of the fuels.
Burning will occur as favorable weather conditions present themselves. It'll start at approximately 8 a.m. and conclude around 3 p.m. daily, depending on the weather. More information can be found about CAL FIRE prescribed burns at fire.ca.gov on the fuel reductions dashboard. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Microgrids can be a lifeline in remote areas prone to power outages, according to local and tribal leaders in Northern California. Leaders spoke at an event on energy security in an era of wildfires, drought, and sea level rise, all linked to climate change. Suzanne Potter has more.
Dr. Arnie Jacobson, director of the Schatz Energy Research Center at Cal Poly Humboldt, says microgrids often involve solar panels plus battery storage.
So during normal operation, they're connected to the regional grid and they can export power and generate revenue. And during a regional grid outage, they operate in island mode and can provide resilience energy services.
Microgrids have gained popularity in recent years as utilities have had to shut off power intermittently during wildfires and high wind events. Jacobson adds that the Willow Creek and Hoopa substations and their associated circuits in the Humboldt area are frequently on the top 10 list of least reliable circuits in the state. Beth Burks, who directs the Redwood Coastal Energy Authority, says its microgrid serves as backup power to the airport and kept it online for 15 hours in December 2022 when an earthquake knocked out power.
We're all familiar with how important it is to keep the airport going. We do our emergency medical transport out of there. And the Coast Guard serves 250 miles of search and rescue territory. And again, we can keep them going when we go into islanding.
Islanding is the term for a system that can kick in and power a local area when the main utility grid goes down. Heidi Morganup with the Blue Lake Rancheria Tribe says its microgrid saved the day during the 2022 blackout, keeping several tribal buildings running so they could provide ice, gas, medical care, and lodging.
We want to be known as a safe place to go, the island in times of despair. We're a very small rural community, but we are engaged in technological advances that can help rural global energy access.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Ketchikan-based artist Savannah Lucornu was selected as this year's poster artist for the Alaska Folk Festival in Juneau. The annual spring event seeks art submissions from Alaska creatives. For festival merchandise, including a poster, KRBD's Hunter Morrison sat down with her to discuss how the opportunity will help expand representation of Indigenous artists throughout Alaska.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, sort of what inspires your work as an artist?
I'm part of three different tribes. I'm Tsimshian, Haida, and Nez Perce. So a lot of my inspiration comes from the art styles of my tribes, as well as my family, surroundings, environment, friends, that kind of thing.
And can you tell me a little bit more about, like, what mediums of art that you sort of specialize in?
Yeah, so mainly I draw and I paint. I do a lot of traditional drawing, but I also do digital drawing as well, too, so working with Procreate on my iPad. And then I also do painting, mainly acrylic, but I have, like, done watercolor here and there.
And, you know, I guess how will this opportunity sort of expand not only your work as an artist, but, like, sort of expand the celebration of Indigenous people and Indigenous art?
What I'm hoping for with being the artist for this year's Folk Fest is that my art is starting, it gets started to seen more like widely throughout Alaska, I suppose. I will say it's not my most obviously Indigenous design. I will say all of my art inherently becomes Indigenous because I am Indigenous, but at the same time, like, it's not, there's no form line in it. There's no traditional Native art in it. For this design, but I still hope that that means that people, like, look into, like, even my own art and see more of what I do, and that people just explore more of it.
That was Hunter Morrison and Savannah Lucornu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Nat Cardos, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.